Today is Monday, December 20th, 2021, and we're giving shear with all types of warnings of major flooding today, and I appreciate the people who traveled from afar to show up. I think the main flooding will be more in the center than here, but nechye v'nireh. I just want to make two corrections on my, I dedicated the shiur yesterday to Reb Lazer Waldman, Zecher Tzadik Levracha. It's part of our life, my shevet Bnei Akiva. And according to all the obituaries I'm reading, he studied in Chaim Berlin. Not, I thought Torah Vadas, somehow Torah Vadas is in my mind, so I want to correct that. Secondly, he was not born in Europe. He was born in Israel, 1937, in Petach Tikva. And I know he spoke with an accent, and I don't know why in my mind I have it that he was born in Europe, but I correct myself, he was born in Petach Tikva. That's what I garnered from the obituaries. Also, he had a degree from Yeshiva University. It says Yeshiva University. It must be a master's. I don't know in what. If he was, as far as I recall, he did not have a bachelor's from Yeshiva College. The bachelor's probably is from Brooklyn College, and afterwards he probably had a master's before he went in Aliyah. I'll have to check with my brother. Maybe he remembers something that I don't. Rabbi Tweske, I spoke yesterday. What you sent me is very fascinating, because it opens up the whole question of finding a source, a viewpoint, a Rishon, we'll see next week in the Sunday class, a letter of a tshuva that we never had before. And how does this affect the halacha? And that's what I've referred to so many times, Choshe Mishpat, Daf Simin, Chafhei, and the Kuntres HaShach in Yoredeyer after Simin Reish Membet. And this is a fascinating topic. I've spent many months on it in the Kollel during the last almost half a century of teaching the Sunday class. Okay, now let's come back here. We have, and I also want to mention, and I thank my dear student, he's in America today, Gross, sent me a beautiful interview with Glenn Richter. And Glenn Richter, this interview was in 2005. It was done by people I know, Refusnikim from Leningrad, Abba Taratuta and his wife Ida, Ida Taratuta and Abba Taratuta. And they interviewed him in 2005, and it turned into an entire article. And I have to say, this is a beautiful interview. He was the founder and the main, the heart of Triple SJ. And in this interview, you can see everything I said in class about the establishment. I remember Rabbi Grinstein's question, how they could have Meir Kahana arrested at Brussels. And it's all there in the interview, the hate and love relationship, I would say, between the establishment and an organization like Triple SJ. While it isn't like Meir Kahana's organization, but nevertheless, it went on its own at many times. And that interview was fabulous, and I thank Steve Gross for sending it to me. I greatly appreciate it. Okay, now let's pick up here, and today is we're coming into very important material today, probably next week as well. But I want to come back to the Satmar Rebbe's life, and he now becomes Rav in Satmar, as we said. He already had a presence there from the time the Belzer Rebbe told him, move to Satmar. He had followers. He was very charismatic, and he was a Gaon Adir. I mean, there are no two ways about it. You read his Sfarim, you see the man's breadth of knowledge. There was always machloket. Part of the machloket goes with the fact that the many Gedolei Yisrael, because they're, I would use the word, idolized, and everyone bows to them, they come to the viewpoint that they have truth and no one else has truth. And that's a problem right down the line. I don't have to elaborate. Those of you who lived here in the 1980s know what went on in Agudat Yisrael and the Hasidim and the Litvakin. and the endless machloket. And part of it was that some of the gedolim involved, I don't want to mention names, but I'm right, everyone else is wrong. I can tell you as a Talmud of the Rav never had that feeling. And this explains to you, just the other day I walked into a house of mourning, and it was a classmate of mine who died, another Rabbi Jerry Frankel, another individual, as I mentioned, from that picture. And they did not know the effort and work that we put in, my wife, myself, for so many years to identify all 29 students in that picture. Because some of them are totally blocked. It's not that you forget the face of your classmate, but when the Rav's hand is blocking the face, you have a problem. And we walk into the house of mourning and they throw the picture at me. Who are these people? Do you know them? Well, I couldn't believe it. Malka and I said, wow. Anyway, we explained to them that in Rakaf Aron and Chelik Dal, that everyone is identified, including the late Jerry Frankel, Zecher Tzadik Livracha. And what was funny was that a few days earlier, we were at a medical doctor, a specialist, after she examined and took care, so we spoke in Yonah Dioma. And she spoke to me about that picture because her father is in it. And she said, how did you identify everyone? But then she said something very intelligent. She's not a specialist because she lacks brains. She said, how can this be in front of the Rav? Take a look who's sitting there. Rabbi Abba Braunschweigel, way right, left yeshiva in anger, went to Lander College. I don't want to tell you our last conversation, what he said about the yeshiva and its leaders. Way right of center. Someone like yours truly, Aaron Rekefit, all right? I think I'm slightly right of center. I am right of center on many issues. I realize that, but I'm not right. Rabbi Aaron Lichtenstein, certainly centrist portrayed. And there you have Saul Berman, the spiritual father of Chovevei Torah, all that gave birth to it, Eidat, the Chovevei Torah. And she said, how could the Rav have so many different students? And I told her if she wants to take off 2 years from her medical practice, which would make my wife very unhappy, I said, devote 2 years to researching the class of 1960 revisited. What became of these 29 people? Almost all of them went into Rabbanut and Chinuch and Rashi Yeshiva, etc. Many went in Aliyah. And then I'll give you a letter that the Rav wrote to Erwin, to Yitz Greenberg, and you'll understand the Rav. There are other points of view. You don't have to follow my point. It was very different. But a Hasidic Rebbe does not have that luxury of that viewpoint. And part of the machloket, again, you'll hear people blaming the Satmar Rav. And yes, there is truth that he was surrounded by people who looked up to him, Maisa Nisim, and what he could accomplish, what he could do, Ruach HaKodesh, and that's part of it. But the other part is very simple, something we anachronistically don't understand. And it's very simple. And he says it here in this biography written by a Satmar Chassid, not by Aaron Rekefit. He says it too, that by the 1930s, all over Europe, you had closet Zionists. Some people were big enough to become Zionist openly. The whole Mizrahi movement, the whole Rushuna dynasty. You have endless examples of people who went public and said, our parents are wrong, our Rebbeim are wrong, the previous Rebbe was wrong. But there were many who couldn't do that. And they were what I call closet Zionists. And if I can use a classic Yiddish word, I'm geburchet. How to translate burchet? Who can help me translate burchet? They were constantly complaining, you know. It's like in the closet they're complaining. It's not that they're complaining openly, but stille hate, quietly. And these people were eating the Satmar Rav's heart out, his followers. These were, look at them, they had long beards and prayers and black clothes, but they were Satmar and they were not Satmar. And this goes on until today. I want you to know that one of my grandsons married into a Hungarian family, and part of the family wound up in America, and they're in Satma. They're the biggest Zionists you'll ever meet. But they grew up in Hungary. They grew up in Munkács. This is what they're used to. But their real commitment is everything Satma, Munkács stand for. But when it comes to Zionism, total Zionist. So they were unhappy with the Rebbe. And there always was machlokas wherever he went, when he was Rubin Krul, when he comes to Satma, even when he was in Siget. Either in Siget already they said he's bigger than his older brother, he should be the Rebbe. But the other communities, there were these undertones. And we ended off last week's class with an interesting point, and it's not a point you can answer black and white. Who is the real Satmar Rav? The Satmar Rav talking at the main shul in Satmar, telling the people to wear sheiklach, the women, or the Satmar Rav in the Hasidic shtibel claiming that wearing a sheikl is an isa d'oraita? You understand? And I felt this in the rabbinate. What I said to my shir in YU on Amsterdam Avenue was totally different what I said to my congregants trying to build an Orthodox shul in Maplewood, South Orange, where I didn't even have a minion of Shomer Shabbos people yet. Later, it's a different story. But at the start, and I don't have to tell you, and my example of the Rambam, the Mora Nevuchim, vis-a-vis the Mishnah Torah, is the classic example. And the Rav said, I quote him, I think I quote this actually in my work on the Rav, where Rebbe said, one individual tried to synthesize everything, but I don't believe he was successful. Well, there's the Mora Nevuchim, and there's the Mishnah Torah. Yomo threw in an interesting idea, which we could elaborate on for the next 49 years. Maybe the real Rambam comes up in his Igrot, in his Tshuvot. But I'll tell you, even that is not totally correct, and I'll tell you why. No Tshuvah is written in a vacuum. By the way, this is widely discussed today with the whole question of the Batei Dinim and appointing Dayanim. And one of the key factors that they're looking for is Lamdanim. We have in Israel many, many Lamdanim. It's a blessing. The country has real solid Talmidei Chachamim who are as good as the previous generation. I'll put it that way. But you need someone who understands life in the year 2022. You can't paskin a delicate shaila without understanding life. And it doesn't mean you're mekil or machmir, but the circumstances around the shaila are part and parcel of the question being asked. And it could very well be with the Ikrot HaRambam that you are limited because he's talking to a certain community at a certain time. Okay, but this is why so much has been written. And I need not tell you Professor Twesky, we spoke about him yesterday in class. Others, a world of work has been done at Hebrew U, at Bar Ilan, and it's ongoing. So much has been written on Maimonides that you could probably fill this entire room with Sfarim and articles, and you would probably have to look elsewhere for more space. Okay, now, the Satma Rav comes into Satma. And remember, it's the Belzer Rebbe who sent them there, which becomes important, as you will see. And he went to work, and there were problems that are typical to the rabbinate. And you'll see the way he handled it and why he's so admired. For instance, a mikveh. I used to say, and it could be it's not my own, it could be I heard this from the Rav, but I unfortunately experienced it. I used to say you judge the spiritual tenacity of a community by the way their mikveh looks. And I quote Rav Shmuel Hirsch, he writes that when he came to Frankfurt am Main, the mikveh was, I'm quoting him now, was in an alleyway that a passage for swine used to go by. Dirty, filthy, that's where they had their mikveh. So the Satmar Rav was not satisfied with the state of the mikveh. And the Balabatim told him the usual answer, there's not enough money to build the new mikveh. He went and called in a demolition crew on his own and said, if I'm Rav in Satmar, there has to be a decent, nice-looking mikveh. And he forced the Balabatim already, rebuild and do it properly. when it came to the schlachtoys, the chickens, mainly chickens, and again, you don't remember this, but as a kid, I remember on Bathgate Avenue in the Bronx, Thursday, there were stores set up where Sheikhtim sat, and they must have shechted thousands upon thousands of chickens from 8 a.m. Thursday morning to 11 a.m., 12 midnight. Because everyone ate chicken, and you had to go to the Sheikhet. And it was not the most hygienic place in the world. And I can tell you that in Israel, again, this is not ancient history, before Russia, before Yom Kippur, in Machne Yehuda, yet in for maybe the first 30 years, 40 years I was here, they used to shech the chickens in Machne Yehuda, right there. Now they've got after them, they're yelling, they're shouting, they're demonstrations of the Society for Animals. It's not nice. By the way, the Rambam was very opposed to all kaparet. I do over money. I can't just abolish kaparet. Everyone does it. But all right, if you do it with money, yeshal mila smoke. But you know what the Safmurov did? He saw the Balabatam aren't responding. He went and took money from the Kehila treasury that he had access to, and he had them knock down the little schlachthuis and build a proper one for the slaughtering of chickens. And he told the Balabatam, whatever money I spent, deducted from my salary. You follow? Well, the Balabatam heard that already. They had no choice. Now, his years in Satma, again, we spoke about his wife died in 36, 38 he remarried, and his second... Oh, that's outside or here? And his second Rebbetzin was the Chenshevich Rebbe's daughter. The Chenshevich Rebbe, that's the story I told you that my chaver met the Chenshevich Rebbe's, saw the Chenshevich Rebbe's daughter sitting in Cretona Park. So, in other words, it means Alta Fega was probably an aunt. To the Rebbe that I knew in the Bronx, in Mount Eden, in that area. But the Chenshevich Rebbe, that was the Alta Fega, and she became a very powerful figure, as we mentioned, and with a lot of squiyot. Bika Chaylim, Satmar is famous for it until today, and I know from my own experience that you can recommend anyone to them, they don't check the kippah, they don't check the hat. They're open to everyone. I just hold on 1 second. Fred, I sent you an email. If you want, I can answer you quickly by dictating to Yomo. But if you can wait till next Sunday, I'll do it as an introduction to the class and explain in a little bit more detail what the tshuva is about. So if you can wait, it's fine. Okay. All right, Morai Rabbisai, we have arrived. And here, I want you to remove all prejudice and try to understand. Let me talk Israeli language. When you go into basic training, you're training and training and training. You're doing everything imaginable. You're walking, you're climbing, you're jumping over obstacles. Did you do basic training, or a chaplain doesn't do it in America?
It's a special chaplain school.
So it's not the real McCoy. All right. Anyway, you're shooting, you're throwing grenades, you're going into gas chambers, gas. You know who were excused? Survivors, children of survivors whose parents who lost in the Holocaust in gas chambers. So they were excused from doing it. You were a gas mask, the works. All right, I did all that. All that training is for battle. And, you know, you don't know whether you're going to be in battle 2 minutes, 3 minutes, an hour, a day. You're training for years. I see all my grandchildren were in battle. I have to tell you, unfortunately, we fought wars. We continually fight wars. And as you know, one grandson was injured, another grandson is lucky to be alive. He's in a building that was blown up in Gaza, and he got out of it unscathed and said from that point on he knew God is going to protect him. And these are real frontline soldiers. But all that training is for moments of battle. Now, I've been on battlefields, and I have to tell you, a battlefield, you can have all the training in the world and you can be prepared. A battlefield is helter-skelter. You know how you begin, you don't know how you're going to end. And a battlefield, can I start to describe it to you? Planes are up ahead, helicopters are up ahead, tanks are up ahead, the infantry is coming in. There is so much noise and disorientation. And then, of course, the real problems, they're shooting at you, they're killing you, their bodies, they're wounded, there's a field hospital behind you, there's water, but you have no idea what has to be involved, the logistics. And unfortunately, not everyone comes out of it unscathed, because in moments like that, you don't know what's going to happen to you. You can have all the training in the world, and suddenly you crack under the pressure. And this goes on in life. I can tell you another example. In the First Intifada, so we would walk home from the Kotel through the Old City on purpose. We didn't want to give up the Old City. And we walked, a group of people, after our minyan ended, and two of our people had guns. One of them was Bobby Yesh, one of them was my son-in-law, and we had someone with a gun in front, someone with a gun in back, and we told everyone, keep calm. If anything happens, just fall against the wall, and let the fellas with the guns will take charge. And there was a Rebbetzin Walkman, a wonderful, great woman, and suddenly they were throwing rocks at us, and one person got hurt, and she became hysterical, you know? And with all the training in the world, you tell people the worst thing is, if you become hysterical, you create so many problems. The worst thing in the world is hysterical, yelling, shouting, doesn't help. Keep calm, follow instructions. But you can't fault anyone. These are human beings. And as you know, as a result of our wars in Israel, this is constantly on the news today, recognizing people with trauma as war injuries. I need not tell you that from the Holocaust and, say Hitler killed 6 million, he ruined the lives of another 5 million. But some of that, it's not like my rebbeim, who were frustrated. You know, you saw them in America, they were strangers in a strange land. But some of the people could never adjust to normal life. They had to be institutionalized. We still have in Israel people in institutions as a result of the Holocaust. All right, Germany pays, big deal. They destroyed their lives. And this is what happens. At a moment of tension, you can plan and educate. It may or may not help. Now, why am I telling you all this? Because now let's begin what happened in Germany, and I should say in Hungary as a result of Germany. Hungary was hit last, 1944. So you might think by 1944, by 1941 already, 42, every Jew in the world knew what Hitler was doing. And nevertheless, what could they do? The Hungarians knew the Poles are being killed, the Lithuanians are being killed, the Ukrainian Jews are being killed. But what could they do? You understand? They were hopeful it won't happen to them. They were hopeful the government was more benign. They were not going to cooperate with the Nazis to that extent to kill Jews, citizens, upright citizens, good people. All right. And then even if they wanted to do something, what could they do? Where could they run to? You follow? America, and we can never forgive America, we can never forgive England. America, Canada. Canada, what was that famous book? Even, I believe it is, even one was too much. Even the taking one Jew was too much for the Canadians. America, the doors were closed. England, the white paper, what they did here with Israel, Shem Yerachem, and what could you do? So you can't fault the Hungarian Jews. Some try to run away to Romania. Romania had a more stable government almost to the end, and there the king refused to surrender the Jews to the Nazis. Afterwards, the king was deposed, and even at the end already, Romanians were being killed. So in 1944, the news of the German advancement and they're going to set up a ghetto and in Satmar, and they couldn't hide in the sand, and what are they going to do? And here, they came up with a plan. There was one Jew, I can give you his name, Rav Yosef Meir Glick, a uniquely sincere Askan. And you know, Askanim, this is a big thing in the Haredi world. You have Askanim, people who devote themselves to helping others. They make a living out of it, but they have influence. I once got a call, there was a problem with a divorce. They asked me if I knew, and these are Haredi people, they asked me if I knew any Askan they can contact who could solve the problem. So I called my daughter. She said, explain to these people that the Batei Dinim Askanim simply aren't allowed in. It's family like family court. Outsiders aren't allowed in. You can't do anything. All you can do is shoot the man. But then you have to pay the consequences of shooting someone. There's no easy solution, as you know, on that level. But here, this Askan worked out a plan, and the story I'm going to tell you was not just in Satmar. You had this all over, that he was able to bribe the locals to transport Jews to Cloisenberg. Cloisenberg, if you look at the map, was on the border between Hungary and Romania. And in Cloisenberg, you had a Jew who had contacts with a farmer and his sons. Evidently, they were paid as well, but they risked their lives to a certain degree. And they would smuggle the Jews across the border in Romania, into Romania. By smuggling them into Romania, they would then at least thought their lives would be saved, that they wouldn't be deported to the death camps. Now, in order to work this out, they spoke with the Satmarov, he agreed, and it's a very similar story to the Belza Rebbe. If you recall, we spoke about this years ago. How was the Belza Rebbe saved? They had an army car with Hungarian soldiers who knew some German, and they had the Rebbe and his younger brother Reb Mordechai dressed as Russian soldiers who they captured, and they said that the Belza Rebbe was a high-ranking officer, his brother was his aide-de-camp, and they had phony papers that they were taking them to be debriefed, to check who they are, what they are, what they know, the enemy, the Russians. And that was the whole plan, to whisk them out and get them over to Romania, from where they got to Turkey, from Turkey to Palestine. And by the way, I have to tell you, there was a big problem with this plan, because the Belza Rebbe did not speak Russian. So here you had someone posing as a high-ranking Russian officer captured, and they had miracles. The Belzas will say it's miracles that they were never stopped and questioned in Russian. When they were stopped, they were questioned in Hungarian or in German, and the two soldiers who were well paid were able to answer intelligently. Now, with Cloisenberg, the plan was with Satmar, the plan was to get to Cloisenberg to have an ambulance. And the ambulance, they had a driver, and there was someone assisting the driver, and they would go on to Cloisenberg, And in Kloisenberg, they would go to Stefan, they would go to the Jew first, their contact person, and from the contact person, they would wind up in the hands of the Gentile and his sons, whose name was Stefan, and get them across into Romania. So you know what happened? All this plan is beautiful. But on the ground, when the ambulance was being loaded, people raced in. It was overcrowded. Pandemonium broke out. The driver was worried stiff that it would cause a commotion and Hungarian police would soon arrest them all. They shut the door, threw out some people, and took off to Kloisenberg. The Sapmarov was in the car. He was there. His wife was there. His devoted chassid was there, Ashkenazi. Only one problem. The person who knew where to go in Kloisenberg was one of those kicked out of the ambulance. Glick, the name we mentioned earlier. And they reached Kloisenberg in the middle of the night. They had nowhere to go. They didn't know where to go. They drove around hoping for miracles. And finally, the driver and his aide, the Gentiles, stopped the ambulance, threw them all out in the middle of the night, nowhere, and just turned around and went back to Satmar. So here you have the Rebbe totally left alone, no place to go, no place to turn, totally caught up. And within an hour or two, the Hungarian police come and arrest them all. Sapmarov is now in jail with his wife and with Rabbi Ashkenazi. Now, let me just say a few words about Rabbi Ashkenazi. It becomes a very famous name. Rabbi Ephraim Yosef Dov Ashkenazi. I think I remember his name is Yosef Ashkenazi. That was the name he used. If I'm wrong, correct me, but it was Ephraim Yosef Dov. His years, 1911-2002. He was a very devoted Satmar Chassid. He was a Talmud Chacham. And, you know, the bigger the Talmud Chacham you are, the more you appreciated the Rebbe. Because the Rebbe was Mashahu Miyuchad. Very unique, very special. His father, Reb Yosef Ashkenazi's father, pleaded with him, go with the Rebbe. He left his wife behind, his children behind, his father behind. His father was too old to go. And that part is also part of the tragedy of the Holocaust. How could you leave your parents? How older people? How, imagine someone says to me, run away from your apartment, go here, go there. At my age, I don't have that type of energy. It's not the 1980 when the Mossad tapped me on the shoulder, said, are you willing to go to Moscow to teach Talmud? Then I had energy. Today I would say it's a beautiful idea, but I don't know if I have the energy. And his father did not go. He wound up with his father killed in Auschwitz. His wife was killed. His children were killed. And he accompanied the Rebbe, and he remained with the Rebbe. Whatever the Rebbe went through for the rest of the Rebbe's life and beyond, Ashkenazi was at his side. How did he make a living? He was the publisher, Jerusalem Hebrew Book Publishing Company. It's not Hebrew book. It's not, when I was growing up, all the Sidurin, the Birnbaum, everything else was published by Hebrew Publishing Company. This was Jerusalem. He added on, and he published all the Satmar Sfarim. He published the Satmar Rebbe Sfarim, and he was a spokesman for the Rebbe. When you'll see, we'll come back to this at a later date, that when the RCA had to deal with the Satmar and try to quiet him and tame him, they dealt with Rav Ashkenazi. He was the public figure. He remarried, he had children afterwards in America. He was very highly thought of. And he and the Rebbetzin, as I mentioned, kept the Rebbe going after the stroke in 68. The Rebbe still lived another 11 years, and he remained Satmar Rav. Satmar Rebbe appeared in public. And it was Ashkenazi on one side of him and Rebbetzin Feiga Alta on the other side. Now, they're in jail, they try to sleep a little, they wake up in the morning. What do? The Rebbe's in jail, where do you turn, what do you do? So the jail was below street level where they were incarcerated, but there was a little window on top. Ashkenazi started looking out that little window, stood on the bed, and he sees across the street there's a Jew standing, and it's clearly a Jew with a yellow star, with a long beard, a chassidish yid, actually a belzer, a chassidish yid, a belzer chassid, I believe. And if only they could signal him. And they come up with a plan. Ashkenazi stands on the bed. I mean, could you imagine this would make a movie and no one would believe it. And the Satmaruv jumps on his shoulder and they wave. And the man across the street looks down and he recognizes, that's the Satmaruv. So he signals them that he understands, and he immediately went to work. And by midday, they're in the ghetto. They are out. Now that particular individual was Reb Chaim Ernster, E-R-N-S-T-E-R. He later perishes in the Holocaust. His son survives. His son marries the Vishnich Rebbe's daughter. If anyone here is a Vishnich Chassid, the name Ernster is very big in Vishnitz. He, the son-in-law, already built branches of Vishnitz. He was involved in Israel in spreading Vishnitz. He played a big role in putting Vishnitz on the map. And you know that in the state of Israel, Ger is the biggest Hasidus, Belz is probably second, Vishnitz is third. And it's a tremendous achievement because Vishnitz is firstly subdivided and subdivided and subdivided. Everyone from that dynasty becomes a Rebbe. If a Rebbe dies and leaves 10 kids, and the 10 kids can at least be Rebbeim, you know, that they're not entirely out of the picture, they all become Rebbeim, and Vishnitz B'nai Brak is focal, is central, and Ernst is part of the Vishnitz group. Now, here they are in the ghetto, and very depressed, I need not tell you. Chassidim come to the ghetto and plead with the Rebbe to say Divrei Torah. And you see, a chassid, what I'm telling you until now, we talk in terms, well, it makes sense, it happened, this could happen, you look up, there's a chance, you meet people, things in life fall into place. A chassid looks at this, Ruach HaKodesh, Yad Hashem, when again it is Hashgacha Pratit, you have to say it's... We're going to... Okay. Hashgacha Pratit. And then Friday night, and here too, you get a picture of the Holocaust. A lot has been written about this. The banality of the Holocaust, that people could be so cruel and so mean, and then go home and go hear music, hear Mozart, have a good supper, drink wine, dance with their wives, and it's just beyond comprehension. And within a few minutes or earlier, they killed 1,000 Jews. Tomorrow they'll kill another 1,000. God have mercy, what a human being is capable of. And so Friday night, a group gathered around him, and suddenly a middle-ranking SS officer heard Jews are together, and he's speaking. He immediately called in troops, rounded them up, and took them to the central command, and goes over, he wants to see the head officer of the Secret Service of the Germans, Yimach Shmam, and he says, here, these group of Jews are meeting and pling to overthrow the Third Reich, and he's telling the officer, and I have them all lined up across the street against the wall, and they're saying Shema, they're saying Vidui. And the officer's busy. It's Friday night. He's drunk. He's drinking. He's laughing. And he tells the mid-ranking officer, take them back and warn them never to gather again, but don't bother me when I'm partying on a Friday night. And again, how do you look at it? Hashgacha pratit, dafka for the Rebbe, saved his life. Unbelievable. Or Baruch Hashem, it is hashgacha pratit, not necessarily the satmaruv. It's just human beings. The mass murderer is now enjoying wine, liquor, women, song. Don't interrupt him with killing another few Jews. He killed 1,000 earlier and he'll kill 1,000 tomorrow. But you see, again, you get the feeling, the satmaruv. Okay. While all this is going on in 1944, the plan to buy out Jews is starting to germinate. So much has been written on this, and I don't have to tell you, Weissmandl, they wouldn't allow his book, Min HaMeitzah. I think the English translation is Out of the Straits. Ben Hecht paid for it to be published in English. You know who Ben Hecht was? It's a new generation. He was the most famous screenwriter in Hollywood. And he was an assimilated Jew. And he woke up. He woke up to his Jewishness. He was raised on the East Side. His native language was Yiddish. And in middle age, he came back to Jewish consciousness, b'lev v'nefesh. He was one of the real supporters of Bergson and what we call Chirut today and all that was done in America, fighting the establishment, etc., etc. But the name Peter Bergson mean anything to you, Charlie? Does that name? Okay. So he was Rav Kook. He was Rav Kook's nephew. His real name was Cook, Hillel Cook. And he said that Hillel Cook brought me back to the East Side, to my youth, to my Jewish feeling. And he has a lot of schuyat. Again, don't forget, we owe a thank you to Ben Hecht. A lot has been written, a lot has been written. But I want to approach it with a neutral feeling and try to see the pro, the con. What are the facts? We'll never know for sure. Why was the Satmaruv included on the transport? What did Kastner care? Kastner was a Zionist. I would say a labor Zionist. He wasn't a left-winger, but he wasn't a right-winger. He was a labor Zionist, not religious. I don't think there was one labor Zionist religious by this point. Originally, Yushishkin was from, Wolfson was from, David Wolfson, Yushishkin, they were showing the mitzvah 100%. But by now already, it's a different generation. And the Mizrahi, if you're a Zionist and you're from, you're in Mizrahi. The labor Zionist, why? What was involved? Okay. Now, Dr. Yosef Fisher was one of the leading local Jewish activists, Zionists, a member of the Hungarian Parliament. He came from a Frum background. Chassidim believe, b'lev v'nefesh, that his mother came to him in a dream from the other world and said, anything your son-in-law, Rudolf Kastner, Kastner is married to the granddaughter of this woman, the mother, Fisher, son-in-law Kastner, who already was working with the Jewish agency hand in hand and was a big Zionist like his father-in-law and married to the daughter. They believe, b'lev v'nefesh, that the mother, grandmother, came to Fisher and said, you must save the Satmaruv. And if you want to succeed, because logically speaking, how is this going to work? How is this going to work? You're going to have a SEAL trained. You're going to get out to Switzerland. You're dealing with Nazis. How's it going to work? But if you have the Satma Rav in the train, no harm will befall you. And that's how they believe the Satma Rav wound up on the list, in the train, and ultimate salvation. Now, I want to tell you something. Let me record a life experience. Remember, I was born 1937. I can't say I understood everything going on in World War II, but by 1943-44, I understood very well. You know, you look at a little kid, you think he's going to be small and young forever. I look at my great-grandchildren already, 4, 5, 6, those years, they know so much already. And what is happening here? The train, the salvation, the people I knew growing up, survivors, I constantly met them at all times. I went to school with survivors. Now, there was an individual teaching, and actually I took his place as a Rebbe in the yeshiva. Charlie, you may remember the name, Rebbe Meir Simcha Feldblum. Do you remember that name?
He was your Rebbe. 11th grade Rebbe.
Wonderful. Right, you have living testimony now. He was a survivor. He was brilliant. And I remember meeting survivors, and I asked them their story. He was in the partisans, he was in the forests, and they said to me, I'll never forget this, I'm quoting it word by word, we knew Reb Simcha Meir, the young man, who's a genius, an Elui. We said, if we follow him, we will survive. I quote, end quote. This was the attitude. You follow me, Yosef? David. If we follow him, Shlomo, we will survive. And that was the feeling, the Satma Rav, it's an amulet. Okay, I'll put it that way, a kamiya. Save him. If we save him, we will be saved. The train will get there. Now, there's a footnote here that says after they reach Switzerland, Dr. Fischer himself, the father-in-law of Kastner, came to the Satma Rav in Switzerland and said, because of you, we got here. And he told him the story, my mother appeared to me in a dream. So I don't know, you know, is it totally accurate? This is not a PhD thesis, but there's no question whenever you read about the Kastner train and the Satma Rav, you will hear this story. Now, the Satma Rav himself didn't say yes right away. You have to understand, he was not the Rav. Mori Urebi, as I mentioned a half hour ago, it was a different attitude. He had students who were right-wing and students who were centrist and students who were left-wing, and he never tried to force you to adopt his way of thinking. And he didn't have less... His respect for you was based upon your ability to learn. You follow? It wasn't the hashkafa. It was your ability to learn. I remember we went over to, we had one student, one of our boys, one of the classmates, was going to go to medical school after he got smicha. A very bright guy. His father was a rav. I don't want to mention his name because you'll see it's a halachic problem. There was only one problem, Yomo. Yes, he was a Kohen. How does a Kohen go to medical school? And this was a big discussion at the time, because in Israel, they were, you know, launching medical schools. And what do you do about Kohanim and cadavers and autopsies, etc.? And I remember we went to the Rav after class and we said, we were pressuring the Rav. You got to remember, we were with the Rav many years. And our feeling of awe for him was one on one level. On the other hand, we were wise guys. We were wise Alex. We fought with him. We were litvaken. We say, Rebbe, this, your Talmud, he's going to make a coin. So the Rav knew what would the Satmar Rav had said. Call him in, you know, wash the floor with him. The Rav said, why are you bothering me? His father's a Rav. Let his father deal with it. And it was, that was a terrific answer. And the truth was, his father was a Talmud of Rav Yitzchak Kohen Cook. And whatever, he became a successful medical doctor. How they dealt with that problem, I don't know. But Baruch Hashem, his children, grandchildren, everyone is Yirei Mushleimim. But the Satmar Rav was very apprehensive lest this was a trap, because no one fought Zionism more publicly, more stridently, more vehemently than he did. He took the place of the Munkacha. The Munkacha already was not alive, and he was the one who fought bitterly. And suddenly the Jewish agency representative is coming to him to put him on a train to save his life with some story that appears quixotic. Quixotic is the proper word. Going to go on a train and go to Switzerland. Well, he evidently checked it out, and he was told that it's real, that they're going to be something like 1,500 people on the train, including Kastner, including Fischer, and it goes with the assumption we always make that no pilot is going to crash a plane on purpose. By the way, that assumption is not perfect. You already know there have been incidents where pilots want to commit suicide or want to kill non-believers, if you don't believe in Islam, and they'll crash the plane and they'll become a Shiad. And they have, 72 versions in the next world, which shows you their concept of women and their attitude towards women. God have mercy. So, but we go with an assumption that essentially a pilot flying a plane is not going to crash the plane. There's a pilot, a co-pilot. I think there's a third person on the plane who can take over if need be. But the Satmar Rav agreed. And the Satmar Rav, with his wife, with his Gabbai, who we adopted now as his own son, Yosef Ashkenazi, they're spirited out of Cloisenberg. Everyone is transferred in a special car to Budapest. In Budapest, they come to a home that previously had dealt with ill people. Now it's totally empty, and they come to this home, and from there the train doesn't go immediately to Switzerland. It stopped. It's in Bergen-Belsen. Some of the people are separated. You can read all about it. The details are well known. There's more negotiation, more money paid, and finally a small group gets to Switzerland, and in December of 44, the big group gets there, including the Satmar Rav. Now, what's fascinating is that in Switzerland already, there were some very prominent Belzer Chassidim. Chassidim who got there earlier, did well financially, and remained very close to Belz, to Europe, to where they came from, to the Rebbeim, to the Hasidut, and they were like joyful the Rebbe has arrived. All right, you can understand this. They greet him, and what's interesting is that on this train, the first train was small, but the second train, a major group, were famous scientists, famous psychologists, famous mathematicians, famous opera singers. And we have memoir literature where they write, no one paid attention to us. No one cared about us. Everyone wanted to see, to touch the Wunder Rebbe, the Rebbe who does wonders, the Satmar Rav. Fascinating. He arrives. Most of the people are Mechalel Shabbos, Lo Aleinu. They move on Shabbos. He can't budge. He's stuck in, I believe, with St. Gallen, one of the cities which they came to originally. And there, Reb Moshe Soloveitchik plays a big role. Now, we'll talk about Reb Moshe Soloveitchik in a few minutes. We'll talk about him separately because he deserves his own little biography. But obviously, you see from the name Soloveitchik, he was a first cousin to the Rav. Okay? His father and Reb Moshe Soloveitchik were brothers, children of Reb Chaim. And here, his life story, fascinating. He winds up in Switzerland, and he becomes, while the Satmar Rav is in Switzerland, Reb Moshe Soloveitchik is his guardian angel. And you got to remember that Reb Moshe Soloveitchik hears the Satmar Rav, after going through hell, he has someone to talk and learning with, someone who's knowledgeable, someone that they can relate to each other. And this Reb Moshe Soloveitchik becomes crucial to the Satmar Rav staying in Switzerland. Now, in Switzerland, right away, the survivors, the Satmar Rav, other Rabbanim, they didn't waste time. They immediately would speak and encourage. And remember, to go through the Holocaust, to run away, to hear the news of everyone you left behind, dead, wife, children, brothers, sisters, parents, grandparents. Remember, Borough Park used to describe itself as a generation that had no grandparents. There's a lot of truth to it. A generation that had no aunts and uncles. He had individual survivors, miracles. Satmar Rav, among others, he wasn't the only one giving people encouragement that we can't understand God's ways, but if we don't believe in God, we have no real life. And you got to give all the credit. This is the story I always tell of my own life experience right here in Rav Chaim Berlin, 18. Generally speaking, anyone who bought in to Rav Chaim Berlin 18 when the building was built in 1968-69, they stayed and never budged. At this point in life, Malka and I are among the few people from the original settlers, we call them, in that building. That's life. It's 53 years already. The apartment next to mine had no mazel, right next to mine. There are three apartments on the floor. The other apartment is still in the hands of the original people, although the man is dead. He was Reb Chaim Zonnenfeld's grandson. His widow should live and be well. We never had an argument in 52 years, 53 years living side by side. There's one more apartment. And that apartment has changed hands and changed hands. It was originally in the hands of the lawyer who was the lawyer for the builder. And then he moved on to bigger things. I wouldn't exactly give the builder and others as the most ethical people, but that was the type of people who worked in that industry 50 plus years ago. As a matter of fact, the builder of my house, 18 Berlin, winds up in jail afterwards. So it gives you an idea what we're dealing with. I can tell you more, so it's not for now. But with the apartment, many years ago it changes hands again, and a widow comes into that apartment, Hannah Stein. And her children, a son and a daughter, tell us that we sought out the building. We heard they're very nice neighbors here. And our mother has gone through a difficult life. She lost her first husband and children in the Holocaust. She remarried a man who lost his wife and children in the Holocaust, and they have two children together. He was very prominent in Misrat HaOtzar, and she's been widowed, and we bought this apartment for her. And she was a wonderful neighbor for many, many years. One of our mother neighbors was, of course, Rav Yehoshua Huttner. He tried lekarev ota, invite her Friday night. They were like in the same age range. And she always refused. And she said, my father was president of the Mizrahi in Czechoslovakia. I went through the hell of the Holocaust. I have no belief left. Friday night is not for me. And Rav Huttner and I would discuss it. You can't fault her. You can't argue with her. It's something I've told you many times. People who went through that hell, we can't start to comprehend it. It was a different world, as they say. And I notice she has a granddaughter who would visit her. And the granddaughter was from North Tel Aviv, people who made it here. And, you know, a typical Israeli girl. And she would meet me in the elevator, meet me in the building, and say, Mashlomcha Mar Rakefet. Underline Mar Rakefet. No one, but no one calls me Mar Rakefet. It's either people who are stupid call me Harav Rakefet with their Acheretz. People who I know many years, it's Ani, it's Aaron, a Talmud calls me Rebbe, fine. Mar Rakefet. And then she's in the army. And one day I'm riding up with her in the elevator, the fourth floor, the top floor. And she's in the army, and she's wearing a skirt, an army skirt. A few weeks later, I meet her. She's coming in with her boyfriend. I take a look. Beard, everything I don't have. Payas, tzitzit outside. And they marry, and I said to my students at that time, and they'd be recorded, and why you try? I said, you know, you can run away from God, but ultimately God catches you. And it was just beautiful to see. If I want to go a step further and entertain you, I fast forward, and I get a call, I can't mention names. They want me to be the rabbi for a bar mitzvah of a very prominent, wealthy family in the great synagogue. All right, I call my daughter. You know, if I would have gotten this call when I was 40, 50, oh my gosh, I would have jumped the ultimate dream, a rabbi in the great synagogue for Shabbat, put up in a five-star hotel for Friday through Sunday across the street. And I called my daughter, my eldest daughter. I said, look, this is the family. She said, Abba, you have to do it. They've done lots of good for Yiddishkeit. It's a well-to-do family. They help victims of Arab terror. My daughter has done pro bono work for them. I said, okay, fine. And it was an unbelievable experience. First of all, I have to tell you, I spoke, and the whole choir is sitting there. And I figured, and I'm going to speak, an idiot from America, what a rake, they're going to go to sleep. Said the Shagai, I couldn't believe it. I finished speaking. A mob, they're hugging me. They're Yashikayach, Yashikayach. Oh, that's a good choir. That choir, they're davening with Kavanah. If they understand the Rub's talk and has their cherets and appreciates, wow. Where we ate, I don't want to mention anymore. I don't want you to identify. it was turned into a ballroom as if we're in Vienna in the 1600s. You should see what they, these people, and the crowd sitting there, diamond dealers, Belgium, Paris, New York, Jerusalem, Tel Aviv, the women with the rings on their hands, millions of dollars are flashing at you when the light hits the diamond, the 4-carat diamond. Oh my gosh. And I'm the only rabbi there. There's a reason why. There was another rabbi they wanted, and he was facing a trial, and the great synagogue couldn't do it if he's found guilty. It's one thing, innocent, but while he's facing trial, we can't afford another. That already been one scandal there. So I was the fallback. And I'm the only rabbi, and I'm being in Harav Hagon, Harav, and I'm speaking, Baruch Hashem, I know how to speak. Oh, you don't know what went on, the covenant. And who is sitting there? That poor girl's married to the son of the Parisian branch of the family that came in Aliyah, and she, and they already have a child, and I have terrific nachat, and she is sitting there hearing Harav Hagon Marakefet. Get it? Oh boy, did she get an education. Don't judge a book by its cover. Got it, Mark? All right, back here. Gentlemen, you got to give the Satmar of credit. Not only that, they did something else, and I want to call your attention to this too. Very important. If these survivors had followed their own instincts, they would have said, what I have gone through, I buried a husband, I buried children, I can't start over again. They were just totally, I would say, demoralized, no energy, no spirit. And if you read my book on Reb Lazer Silver, The Silver Era, Shlomo, you'll see when he went into the tipi camps, he gave out money, but he always put a condition that you remarry and start all over. And the Satmarav and the Rebbetzin, particular Rebbetzin Feger, they already were making Shidduchim in Switzerland. And this is critically important because I can tell you, in the 60s, the 70s, when I started teaching, how many children I taught who came from a second marriage of Holocaust survivors. We must have in the world today another few hundred thousand, if not a 500,000, if not more, children of Holocaust survivors who were encouraged and had the guts to go further. And you have to give the Satmarav, you have to give the Rebbe, and there are many others. They were not the only ones. But this was fabulous. This was fabulous. And it's not easy. It's not easy. Hannah Stein, that lady who next door to me, you got to give all the credit, had a son, daughter, grandchildren. And from this granddaughter, who knows how many great-grandchildren there'll be. And ultimately, it keeps us going. We're doing much better today, statistic-wise, as Jews. And you got to give credit. Now, yeah, life doesn't stand still. This is like a replay of Kobe, Japan, with Shanghai. The Swiss government starts to pressure them. You know, we've only let you in for 6 months. Get the hell out. We don't want you here. It's like Kobe. I don't know if you know the details, but Kobe, the Jews get there and they're told, well, you got to go further. Some did get to Canada, some did get to America, but the overwhelming majority were thrown into Shanghai. That's how the Jews, how the Rebbeim, how the Mir Yeshiva winds up in Shanghai. Now, where do you go? Where do you go? So the Satmarav, remember we said he had one daughter, Rosa, who was married to her first cousin, Teitelbaum. And They got out. They got to Israel. They already got out. And here you have the tremendous problem. I can still remember Rav Shmuel Lazer Volk getting hysterical in class. The Jewish agency controls the visas. Do they want the Satmar Ruv in Israel? Do they want anti-Zionists in Israel? And I remember we were B'nai Akiva kids, and we told Reb Lazer Volk that why didn't they go in Aliyah? And he got hysterical. The Agudat Yisrael couldn't get visas. And there is truth to it, obviously. You understand? Look at the politics in Israel today. And in order for him to get a visa to Israel, and it's all here, all the facts here, he would have to sign a document that he will not be anti-Israel, will not preach anti-Zionism in Israel. I need not tell you, he refused. His daughter and son-in-law did sign the document, and they got to Jerusalem. They got from Romania to Turkey, to Palestine, to Jerusalem. Later, they joined the Satmar Rav in New York, and he had a shtibble. His son-in-law had his daughter died right away, quite young, no children, in New York, but they had a shtibble on the Upper West Side. All right? He turns to relatives in New York. Which relatives? From his first wife's family. And there already were cousins in New York, try to get him a visa. And while all this is happening, pressure is being put on the Jewish agency. Look, Kastner saved his life. He's a great Rav. He's a great Talmud Chacham. He has skuyot. All right, so he's not a Zionist. Maybe living in Palestine, it will change him, will have an impact on him. Finally, the Jewish agency, it could be Kastner's influence as well, the visa comes through. Goes to Italy. Here in Italy, I have a share. One of my greatest students out of the 60s is Dr. Avi Freilich. Naming anything to you? He's a dermatologist in Queens, very well known, semi-retired today, coming in Aliyah. One son is here already, more will come. Avi Freilich's father was Harav Yitzchak Freilich, Isaac Freilich. I knew him as one of the heads of the Mizrahi in America. At this moment in time, he was a survivor. He was a regular Zionist Hasidish Jew. But there are cherets for the Satmar Rav. He was in Italy. In Italy, there was a tremendous Aliyah Bet. This is where they all sailed to Israel, to Palestine, from Italy. Italy was a tremendous launching center. It's an amazing story. In Italy, Italy fought with Hitler, Mussolini, but Jews were not killed in Italy. It's an amazing story, whatever the reasons are. And you got to remember, the mafia in New York was doing its share. Frank Sinatra, you got to give credit. Got to give credit. Frank Sinatra, what we were doing. And it was Rabbi Isaac Freilich who was of tremendous help to the Satmar Rav while he was in Italy. And he saw him off. By the way, in this biography, you don't get too much information about Rabbi Freilich because he was a Mizrachist. But others and information from the Freilich family and some Mizrahi publications, you learn about Rav Yitzchak Freilich. I remember him well. had two children, an older daughter, Zichrona Levracha. She became the dean of students, or the dean entirely, of the branch of Touro in Los Angeles. That was his elder daughter. I don't know how, I forgot her marriage. I actually met her when I was in Los Angeles.
When did he get to Italy?
World War II. When did he get to Italy?
I mean, after the Americans...
This all happens in 45, 46. He was there already. I can't give you the exact year. But he was there. He was a Rav. He was active. He was helping the Aliyah Bet. Had great skuyot. When it was over, he came to America. He was Rav of a small shul in Brooklyn and very active. I think he was the national executive director of the Mizrahi organization, working under Rabbi Mordechai Kirschbaum. You follow? And his son was my Talmud in the 60s, and he went on to become a big Talmud Chacham, but a medical doctor, etc., etc. Now, let me say a few words about the... And this is where we leave the Safmarov. He's now on the way in 46 to Palestine, to Eretz Yisrael. Let me say a few words about Reb Moshe Soloveitchik. Reb Moshe, first of all, his years 1914 to 1995. He was the son of Reb Yisrael Gershon Soloveitchik. His father, Reb Yisrael Gershon, was the son of Reb Chaim. So I don't have to tell you what this yichus was. The son was not on the level of learning. In other words, there were two brothers who were goyim adirim. One brother was, of course, Reb Moshe Soloveitchik. And one brother was Reb Velvel, was Reb Yitzchak Zev Halevi Soloveitchik. Who was greater in learning? So a lot has been written about this. It's not for us to go into it, not to judge. But I would say they were both giants, Reb Moshe and Reb Velvel. Reb Moshe, of course, got out of Europe in December of 29. Rabbi Revel was pleading with him to come to New York to head up Yeshivas of Schochanan. Reb Yisrael Gershon remained behind in Europe. And Reb Zev Velvel got out and running away from Hitler, finally got to Palestine in 41. And it's a tragic story. His wife didn't want to leave her parents behind. So the older children were the Reb Velvel in Vilna, and they were saved. And the younger children stayed with the mother, taking care of her parents, and they perished in the Holocaust. Now, Reb Moshe Soloveitchik, the Reb Moshe we're talking about now, again, don't confuse him with the American Reb Moshe, the one we're talking about, Reb Moshe, the nephew of the American Reb Moshe, he grew up in Brisk. His best friend was Rabbi Aaron Leib Steinman. Rabbi Steinman, who we mentioned yesterday in the context of Rabbi Moshe Weinberger and what Rabbi Weinberger spoke about, and I confirmed that every syllable is correct as far as Israel goes, because that I know. Rabbi Steinman was born in Brisk, grew up in Brisk. Both of them were childhood friends, childhood chavrutot, learned in the yeshiva Torat Chesed of Brisk, which was like a on the level of what Rabbi Chanan Wasserman taught. It was like a pre-yeshiva gedola yeshiva, but where you learned on a very high level. And the Rosh Yeshiva died in 1931 without any children. Machloket broke out who would succeed the Rosh Yeshiva. And this, I don't have to tell you, was a Lithuanian saga that the yeshiva, essentially in Lithuania, were all family institutions. And if the family couldn't produce a top-level Rosh Yeshiva,
you would have machloket, or the yeshiva would close. And this repeats itself. It repeats itself in America. Tells yeshiva is a prime example. In the 50s, the 60s, Tells was a shame dover. Wow. And later, when Reb Mordechai Gifter died, Reb Saretskin took over Baruch Saretskin. He died, Reb Mordechai died. The family had no one to take over. And it's today, when you speak of Tells, you speak of Chicago, you speak of Riverdale. Those are branches. The real Tells in Wycliffe, Ohio, suburb of Cleveland, is really not on the map anymore. And it's a problem. So when this machleket broke out, both Reb Aaron Leib and both Reb Moshe decided to leave and go to the heart of Poland, where you had already great yeshivat. Reb Aaron Leib goes to Kletsk. He studies in Kletsk. That's already Reb Aaron Cutler's yeshiva, Reb Yisus Amram Meltzer. It slips to Kletsk. Later it comes to Lakewood. And he studies in Kletsk. And Reb Moshe goes to Yeshivat Knesset Beit Yitzchak in Kamenetz. So it's interesting. The two good friends, Chavruta, parted. But then years move on, 31, you're now 35, 36, and war clouds are gathering, and the Polish army is drafting. Now, I need not tell you, a lot has been written why the Rav went to Berlin. And Rav Heschel Schachter wrote, he went there to run away from the Polish draft. It plays a role. There's no two ways that the Rav left, but he was going to go to Berlin no matter what. The only question was when to go. And the Polish draft became more of a catalyst, but the Rav was seeking Western education. So the two Chavruta, they start going for long walks. They eat less, what we spoke about in yesterday's shiur. They're on a diet. Less food, less drink, to flunk the physical exam. And what happens is they don't flunk, they are put on the waiting list. In other words, they're not healthy enough to be grabbed immediately, but if war should break out and they need more soldiers, they will be brought in. So with that in mind, they go away to Switzerland. They cross the border, they get out jet, they travel, and both of them wind up in Switzerland.
They went to different yeshivas, then they came back again?
Or? No, they went to Switzerland. One went, I believe it was Reb Steinman who went first, and yeah, and Reb Moshe, they corresponded. There's a place in Switzerland, there was Rabbi Butchko's yeshiva already, where they needed them as teachers, and they went to Switzerland. Now, in Switzerland, they suspected the Jews by 1940. This went on all over, went on in Britain, went on with the Japanese in America, if you recall. They're suspected of espionage. They're Jews from a foreign country. They're put into labor camp. They're observed. And after a number of months in labor, people intervene for them, they get out, they both go on to Palestine. Rabbi Steinman remains in Palestine. Rabbi Moshe Soloveitchik is here for a good few years, studying in the Lumshi Yeshiva in Petach Tikva. Now this too is a part of Torah history in Israel that very few people know. The most prominent yeshiva that came in from Litta was the Lumshi Yeshiva that found its home in Petach Tikva. They actually brought in Reb Chaim Sterich. They brought in all the East European learning. In that sense, they eclipsed the Hebron Yeshiva that had moved to Yerushalayim from Hebron after the massacres in 1929. Reb Shmuel Rozovsky, they give him credit. He's a name that's barely known today. out of Lumsha in Pepach Tikva, and they were then, Reuven Katz was there, Rabbi Chiel Mordechai Gordon, it was all the biggest Lamdanim. That gave birth to Panovich. When Panovich began and the Panovich Rav and he needed people, he brought in the elite. I mean, this was the Panovich Rav. He dreamt on that mountaintop, he's going to rebuild Europe. Everyone laughed at him. Boy, they didn't last long. He brought in, and ultimately Panovich took over for Lumsher and Petach Tikva. To a certain degree, Panovich is the continuity of Lumsher. And that's where Reb Moshe learned. He became very close to the Chazon Ish. Later, in 1948-49, a shidduch was made with a prominent family in Switzerland, and he returned to Switzerland, where for years he was a Rosh Yeshiva, he was in the rabbinate. I understand he really didn't have to work, it wasn't salary, he already was part of a very prominent, well-off family, but he was the focal rabbinic figure in Switzerland, particularly after the death of Rabbi Chiel Yaakov Weinberg. You see, Rabbi Chiel Yaakov Weinberg, after World War II, the Sri Deish had no place to go. He was not married, had no family, he was divorced, never remarried, no children. He had a Talmud in Switzerland, Pantrei, Rabbi Shaul Weingart. And Rabbi Shaul Weingart, his Talmud Mufak of the 30s, when he studied in Hildesheim in Berlin, took him in to his house. And never, we Jews have no mazel. You all know the story. In 46, he was giving shir in the family yeshiva in Monterey, and he was waiting for the trolley car, and he was run over. And Reb Shaul Weingart died very young, but his family, his widow, the children, took in Rabbi Chiel Yaakov Weinberg, and he lived in a mother-daughter house arrangement, lived with them in his own little area for the rest of his life. And Kolzman, he was alive, and he was a tragic figure, not semi-tragic, but tragic. Because you know his story, he should have come to Jerusalem. He said, if I come to Jerusalem, I don't know where to go, I'll have trouble. I go to Hebron Yeshiva, he had studied in Slabodka. The Hebrew University will be mad at me, he had a PhD from Berlin. And if I go to Hebrew University, Hebron people will be mad at me. And you know his funeral, the doctorate done by my Talmud, that magnificent doctorate. So when you read the doctorate you study, how does it begin? With Rabbi Chiel Yaakov Weinberg's funeral. And what happened at the funeral was in 66, I believe. It's right before we came in Aliyah. We weren't there at the funeral. And the body is brought in from Switzerland, and the body is brought to Jerusalem, and they start walking to Sanhedria to bury him in the section in Sanhedria of Gedolei Chachmei Yisrael. And the Rosh Yeshiva, Rav Chatzkel Sana, Rosh Yeshiva of Hebron, says absolutely not. He was a gadol b'Torah. And they say with his cane, he said, we're not budging, don't turn towards Sanhedria, turn towards HaMenuchat. And they buried him in the Chelkat HaRabbanim, Har HaMenuchat. But Kol Zman Rebbe Chiel Yaakov Weinberg was alive, any Talmud Chacham who came to Switzerland went to see him, went to consult with him. But after his death, Reb Moshe Soloveitchik becomes a key figure. And I can tell you a story I heard from reliable sources that a member of the Soloveitchik family traveled to Europe for the first time, traveled abroad, and he went on he used his mother's maiden name, Levitt. not the Soloveitchik name. He didn't want to be bothered. People would know he's a son of Mori Urebi, a son of the Rav. He didn't want to be bothered. He used the name Levitt. That's, read my work on the Rav, you'll see the name, that's her maiden name. So he comes to Switzerland and he goes to see Rav Moshe Soloveitchik, and they start talking and learning. And Rav Moshe Soloveitchik says to him, "You're a Soloveitchik," he says. "Don't," he says, "only a Soloveitchik can talk the way you do." And he had to admit that he taka was a Soloveitchik in the full sense of the word. All right, so look what we've done today. We've brought you the Satmarov, the Kastner train, and we'll go on to Palestine. But before we go on to Palestine, next week, the first part of the shiur is crucially important. Who was Kastner? Did he do the right thing? Did he deserve to stand trial? Should we curse him or should we bless him? I got emails. I mentioned Kastner. You can't believe how sharp the emails were against him. And this machloket just went on a few weeks ago. You're not even aware of it. We'll come to it. They celebrate the day he arrived in December is like Yutet Kislev for the Satmar. Had the biggest dinner in New York, thousands of people. And a Talmud from who studied me in the Kollel, Rabbi Pupka, wrote a whole essay against it. Not to celebrate. Who is he? A murderer. We'll see why. And I hope when it's all over you'll have a more balanced view, because we're dealing with problems, as I will show you. There's no black and white. This is the last topic I spoke about with the Rav, eye to eye, person to person, 1983. So my dear students, first of all, are there any questions from the erudite group of young people and slightly older people sitting in front of me? To be honest, some of us are four times your age, three times your age, but Baruch Hashem. If there are no questions, I want to thank you, Mark, come over here. I want to thank you very much for your participation and honoring me with your presence. And until we meet again in health and happiness, Das Vedanya. Okay? And Mark, please turn it off. See if there are any questions from around the world. Are you still awake in New York? What's going on? Okay, 1 second. What do you do next?
That's okay. You should be able to talk.
Can they speak now? Did you unmute?
Yes.
Can you speak? Anyone have any questions?
Rebbe, just what you said, it says on Waldman, it says he has had a BA from YU, but it doesn't seem right because he made Aliyah at a young age. So he came back to his really young age. So
I don't know how he had a BA. He was my age exactly, born 1937. He was a Maishevet Bnei Akiva, and he did not graduate YU and I did that much, and then graduated Yeshiva College. Maybe after, but I don't remember him at all. Yitzchak, Rabbi Rubin, do you remember Laser Waldman? No, he doesn't remember him either. And it's funny, I didn't remember him, but there was a big crowd in Bnei Akiva that were Talmidim of Rav Chutna. I always thought he was Torah Vadas. I don't know, but I saw both on Yeshiva World News, did I see it, or on a Rich Sheva, and then I went to Wikipedia, and I see they say he's a Talmud of Rav Yitzchak Kutner. All right, he's most important. When he came to Israel, he went to Merkaz Arab, and he became a Talmud Mufak of Rav Tzvi Yehuda Cook. That is a fact, and he has tremendous skuyot. He was in Chevron, he's part of the original settlers, and he built the yeshiva. Built the yeshiva in Chevron. Okay, are there any other questions? Okay, in Dr. Nadir, Professor Nadir, I'll answer your question next Sunday, Bezrat Hashem.
All right, thank you very much.
You're very welcome. my pleasure. Until we meet again in health and happiness, and survive the floods in dignity. At least they're scaring us with the floods. Until we meet again in health and happiness, das vidanya. Okay. Bruchim to you. Bruchim to you. Bruchim to you. Bruchim to you.